copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
This session's called Making Disciples in the Way of Jesus. And I don't know about you, but sometimes so often we can look for what's the church down the road doing to make disciples, or what is the best resource that's being advertised, and how are some other people doing, what models are there for disciple making. And really for this session, what we're going to do is try to take, and it won't be a full overview of the life and the ministry of Jesus, but we're going to try to look at certainly at least two passages and examples of how Jesus, the method that Jesus used in making disciples. I don't know if education was similar for you at school, but whenever I took the maths class, thank you, there's my son bringing something to me. Whenever I took maths class in school, we constantly had to try to get the right answers. But as I got the right answers, that was never enough for the teacher. And the teacher always told us, it's not enough to get the right answer. You have to write down the method that you use to get the right answer. This always really frustrated me. If I'm honest, I thought, if you have the right answer, it doesn't really matter how I got there. But I think the teacher was trying to prove that I hadn't just copied it from a friend or I read the answer from the back of the book. They wanted to see our method. And this afternoon, I want us to consider the method that Jesus had or made as he made disciples. And I think you had a session from Greg Ogden earlier on in the week. And I want to share with you a quote from a book of his called Transforming Discipleship. And he writes this: Scripture is not only a message book, but also a method book. It conveys the what, but also the how. Embedded in the story of the good news is instruction and modeling of the means we are to use to ensure its transmission to the lives of the next generation. My fundamental assumption is that we have less of a message problem today than we do a method problem. We haven't been looking to Scripture to show us how people grow to maturity in Christ. And obviously we attach lots of significance to the things that Jesus said, and rightly so. But as well as listening to what Jesus said, I want us to see what Jesus did and how Jesus made disciples. So what was the method of Jesus? Let's begin by looking to a few verses in Mark chapter 3, verses 13 to 15. Really, the passages I'm trying to look at with you are ones that I think give a bit of an overview or a summary of some of the things that he did. So Mark chapter 3, verses 13 to 15 tells us this: Jesus went up on a mountainside and called to him those he wanted, and they came to him. He appointed 12 that they might be with him, and that he might send them out to preach and to have authority to drive out demons. And then the next verses name these 12 that he had called. Three little principles that I want to think about with you this afternoon. First of all, Jesus invested in a few. And it's interesting to me how the journey of Jesus, of discipleship, started for Jesus here. He had already gathered a larger group of followers who were following him at this time. But Jesus moved from attracting a crowd to beginning to invest in just a few. He went up on a mountainside and we're told that he appointed 12. And this was a crucial moment, and the parallel passage in Luke records how Jesus had spent all night in prayer before doing this. But I find the approach of Jesus fascinating here, because he could have done ministry in whatever way he wanted. He could have filled stadiums. He could have toured the world. He could have drawn crowds wherever he wanted. He could have put on a miracles tour. He could have influenced kings and convinced Caesars, but yet he chose to invest in a small group who went on to impact the whole world. And I want to make it clear that, yes, Jesus loved everyone equally, but he didn't invest his time equally. Excuse me, I'll say that again. Jesus loved everyone equally, but he didn't invest his time equally. These are five numbers. You may have seen this before. These are five numbers that are associated with the life and the ministry of Jesus. We're aware that he taught the crowds. He fed 5,000, well, more than 5,000 of them. Then there's these 70 or 72 other followers, this wider group who he sent out in mission in Luke 10. Then there's 12, obviously, that we're reading about in this passage. Then there's the, within the 12, there's these three, Peter, James, and John. And then regularly we find Jesus alone with his Father up a mountain or the other side of a lake early in the morning in prayer. And it's interesting to me that actually, if you look at the direction of Jesus' life, the direction that he was often traveling in was away from the crowds to be with the 12, and away from the 12 to be with the 3, and away from the 3 to be with the 1. And yet so often modern church ministry perhaps leads us in the opposite direction. We feel the pressure to build things bigger or do more activities or draw more people in. And we're often asked, you know, how many are coming? That's the measure of effectiveness of a church. But Jesus actually chose investing in a few over impressing the masses or attracting the crowds. And he still did attract the crowds. But the ironic thing is that his direction was often to leave them, and yet he still managed to reach them. He chose the method of investing in a few to benefit the many. He invested in a few to benefit the many. And here's just a little graphic that I came across. It's not mine. I came across it on social media about a year ago, and I really like it, to summarize kind of how we tend to do things in the church, but actually how Jesus model with the numbers was actually the opposite way around. So Jesus invested in a few to benefit the many, and yet maybe we often do the opposite way around. So if it was cheeky, I could maybe ask you, who are your 3 and who are your 12, and how could you be investing in them? Can you identify those people around you or in your church that you could invest some of your time in? Not to ignore the crowds, but to invest in the few that might begin to benefit the many. So Jesus was invested in a few, but he was actually with them as well. So if we go on in this verse in Mark chapter 3, verse 14, it tells us he appointed 12 that they might be with him. You see, Jesus was demonstrating that disciple-making was done up close. It involved him being with them. He didn't just tell them to sign up for a class, or he didn't just give them a book to read, but he actually spent time with them. He didn't just teach them from the front, but he modeled his life side by side and up close along the way. They walked together, they talked together, they ate together, they served together. I think this verse, if I'd have written it, it might have ended differently. He appointed 12 that he might teach them everything. He appointed 12 that they would, you know, do all this stuff. No, he appointed 12 because he wanted to be with him. He wanted them to be with him. He wasn't just a talking head from a distance, but he was a living example up close. And this is, of course, the whole idea of the incarnation, God coming close to his people. And in his discipleship, Jesus prioritized proximity. There's a word from yesterday's session, proximity with people, and sharing his life with them. With Jesus, it wasn't just come and see, but it was come and be with me. And as they were with him, they became more like him. Discipleship involves, that's an important point, discipleship involves being with Jesus. It's not just about doing more stuff for Jesus, but also about being with him as well. So if we're to model Jesus' method or way of disciple making, it involves open lives, and it involves open homes and open hands and sharing our lives, not just sharing our information, but sharing our lives. And Terry talked about this yesterday afternoon. He talked about the word modeling. You know, that son who's 7 years old and just interrupted us at the very start, how will I teach him to cross a road? I could sit him down and give him a class on road walking or road crossing. Or actually what I'll do is I'll take him to the side of a road and I hold him by the hand. And again, I will model to him how we are to cross a road. And I'll talk him through it as we do it. And then I might trust him one day to let go of my hand and to do it for himself. So how might we teach someone how to pray? How would we teach someone how to read God's word? How would we teach someone to share their faith? We've got to not just tell them or explain it to them, but demonstrate it. It's not just explanation, but demonstration. I was a youth worker for years, and so many times I stood up in front of a group of young people and I said something like this. I held the Bible and I said, you need to read this book. If you want to become familiar with God or the ways of God or to deepen your relationship with Jesus, you need to read this book regularly. I was telling them, but just because I told them doesn't mean they all did it. But I'm sad to say that on fewer occasions did I sit down beside a young person and open the book and say, and here's how I do it. You see the difference? Telling people or demonstrating it to them. Robert Coleman writes this, it's good to tell people what we mean, but it is infinitely better to show them. People are looking for a demonstration, not an explanation. So Jesus was actually with them. And it wasn't just hanging out, although it was that too, but it was him modeling life and faith to them. And lastly, it's really important that we see this through these verses. Discipleship isn't just about having better times with God or surrounding ourselves in church activities, but discipleship should lead us outwards. It tells us that Jesus appointed 12 that they might be with him and that he might send them out to preach. And so Jesus was with them, but he was also sending them out. Dan Spader writes this, disciple making for Jesus meant meeting the needs of people where they were spiritually and then challenging them to the next level. His goal was multiplication. And with laser focus, he trained his few disciples to multiply their lives and others. When Jesus called his disciples, he was inviting them into a life of transformation. We'll think about that later in the session. But he was challenging them. He was sending them out. He was preparing them for a life lived on mission. And I think sometimes discipleship and mission are often maybe wrongly separated. But actually, mission can often be one of the best fuels for growth in discipleship. If I think about how I grew most as a young believer, it was times where my faith was stretched because I was in situations where I had to rely on God, or I learned to pray more, or my spiritual antennae were up. How are we engaging our disciples on mission? Because actually that will help them grow. And it's been said before that Jesus didn't tell all the world to go to come to church, but he did tell all the church to go into the world. And so Jesus' model was to grow disciples who would go into all the world, who would be sent out on mission. And for me, the passages of Luke 9 and 10 are brilliant examples of this, where Jesus gathers his disciples together and he gives them instructions, and then he sends them out away from his physical presence. It strikes me in the current climate of the way we're being forced apart, I guess, and not having our gatherings. Actually, we're being scattered, or we have been scattered. And actually, the picture of the church is always this rhythm of gathering and scattering. And so here's Jesus in Luke 9 and 10, and in Mark 3 too. He's gathering them, he's equipping them, and then he's rippling them out, sending them out. Our discipleship needs to prepare people and propel them outwards. So that's the kind of first section of the first block of teaching in this session, thinking about the method of Jesus. And I'll just stop my screen share. What I would love to do just for a couple of moments is just to reflect on that for yourself and for your own context. You've heard a lot of input over the last few days. You've heard a lot of input about discipleship, disciple making. But I would love you to begin to ground this in your own context. What does this mean for you? How could you get practical with the things that you've heard? And so we're going to take just a couple of minutes to reflect, maybe personally first, on your own. And I have a simple question. What strikes you most about Jesus' discipleship method? And what does it look like in your context? So this little teaching input is called The Bookends of Discipleship, Invitation and Challenge. And again, we'll just look at three short verses that give a bit of an overview in Mark chapter 1 in a moment. But I wonder if you've ever sort of noticed or seen the bookends of disciple making within the Gospels. So discipleship was Jesus' first invitation and his final command at the start of his ministry. The start of Jesus' earthly ministry in Mark 1 is an invitation to start a journey of discipleship. And then the end of Jesus' earthly ministry in Matthew 28 is a challenge to become a disciple maker. So on the shores of the Sea of Galilee, they're invited to come follow as disciples. And then on a mountain in Galilee, 3 years later, they are challenged to go make more disciples. So Mark chapter 1 is an invitation to close relationship. And Matthew 28 is a challenge to kingdom responsibility. And I want to explore how these two things, the words of the ideas of invitation and challenge, can become like a dual lens for our disciple making. I wonder if you can see this dual lens, the invitation and the challenge, in these words in Mark chapter 1. It says, as Jesus walked beside the Sea of Galilee, he saw Simon and his brother Andrew casting a net into the lake, for they were fishermen. Come follow me, Jesus said, and I will send you out to fish for people. At once they left their nets and followed him. We don't have time to get into the idea of why these disciples were so keen, why they dropped everything at once and abandoned their livelihood, really, and went to follow some man who just walked up to them on the beach. But the whole idea of apprenticeship, the whole idea of a rabbi and his disciples and being part of this culture, and the whole idea of these young men who were now back at their father's nets, learning the trade because they hadn't actually made it with another rabbi, is a really rich kind of idea and concept, but we don't have time to get into it. Instead, what I want to explore through these verses are these two things of invitation and challenge. So come follow me is the beginning of Jesus' invitation. And for any disciple-making relationship or group or even program to start, it must begin out of a relationship, an invitation to relationship. Jesus wanted to, you know, we've already thought about how Jesus ate and walked and talked and served with these disciples. He allowed people to come close. He was invitational and relational. People wanted to be around him. He didn't disciple from a distance. And so there was an invitation to come follow. But in the invitation, and this is really important, in the invitation, there was also a challenge. And the challenge was that Jesus was actually going to change them. That following Jesus would lead to a change. Come follow me and I will make you. I'm going to change you. I'm going to shape you, Jesus is saying. So actually, as part of this invitation, Jesus didn't list all the benefits, but actually Jesus was telling them, implicit in the invitation was a challenge. Jesus didn't say, you know, come follow me and you're going to have an amazing life. He didn't say, come follow me and I'll make all your dreams come true. That was Walt Disney. He said, come follow me and I will make you fishers of men. There's going to be a challenge that's part of this. And Jesus was constantly challenging. He said challenging things to people like, love your enemies, pray for the sick. He gave challenges to both religious leaders and his closest followers. And he was challenging right from the outset. And at times I wonder if we've set the bar of welcome too high in our churches, if for people to come in as an invitation, actually sometimes we've set the bar of welcome too high, but I also wonder if we've set the bar of challenge and discipleship too low. Dietrich Bonhoeffer wrote, Christianity without discipleship is always Christianity without Christ. You see, Jesus didn't just attract the 12, he called them. He didn't just support them, but he challenged them. He didn't actually just create a cozy club with them, but called them to make a difference in the world. And Jesus perfectly balanced this invitation and challenge. So Matthew chapter 16, he invites Peter into covenant relationship with him, and he tells him, he gives him the keys of the kingdom. And later on in the chapter, he says, get behind me, Satan, to Peter. You hear the invitation, keys of the kingdom, the challenge, get behind me. You know, this is even in the same conversation or chapter, certainly. And this is a very famous scene from a film called Ocean's 11 with George Clooney. I don't know if you've seen it. But in the film, George Clooney, or Danny Ocean as he's called, is trying to hatch a plan with a bunch of thieves and robbers. And he's trying to get them on board with his idea to rob a casino. And outside at this lovely swimming pool, he clears his throat and he tells these 11 men about his plan. And he tells them this. He says, gentlemen, what I'm about to propose to you is both highly lucrative and highly dangerous. In other words, this could make us really rich, but also it's going to be really, you know, it could kill us. And obviously following Jesus does not make us rich, but I think there's something in these words that actually capture the invitation and challenge of Jesus. Jesus, following Jesus, has an amazing eternal reward. But actually there's a cost and there's a challenge. And Billy Graham said it better than George Clooney. There's a surprise. But he said, salvation is free, but discipleship will cost you everything you have. Mark 8 is a famous example of this, where Jesus tells us about the cost and the reward of following Jesus. But he warns his followers that there's a cost. We need to emphasize the cost. We need to emphasize the challenge of our discipleship and in our disciple making. I want to think about just practically what this might mean or what this might look like for us. I think most people, and probably most people in this call today, have a natural tendency towards one or the other of these two things in our disciple making. To make disciples, we need to learn to do both, and we also need to learn to do intentionally what we're maybe not as natural in. So there's natural inviters here in this network. And we need to learn to bring the challenge. You need to learn how to release others into roles and responsibilities. You need to learn how to challenge them, to ask the difficult questions, or to keep people accountable, or to propel them outwards in the ministry or mission. Maybe for some of us, we're natural challengers. We like to challenge people. We like to ask them hard questions or to directly challenge what we see in their lives. And if we're natural challengers, we might need to learn to be maybe more inviting and warm at times, or we need to learn to just enjoy the company of others, to learn to affirm and encourage those who we're discipling, and maybe to learn to spend time with people outside the formal or the programs. And really quickly, I think if you're really strong in invitation, but you're low in challenge, I think that can lead to cozy discipleship. You know, we love hanging out with you. We love being at this church. We love being part of this program, but actually we're not really changing. I think if we're not very good at challenging or invitation, that becomes pretty stagnant quite quickly. There's nobody new coming, and they're not really changing. Hopefully we're not there. I think this is where a lot of church leaders can live, highly challenging people, but maybe not spending so much time with people or developing relationships. That can end up being stressful discipleship. You need to change. You need to do more. You need to emphasize grace in the grace-filled discipleship, as well as the challenge and the cost. But actually, when we can try to balance these things, when we're able to balance these things, that's disciple-making that leads to empowerment. Let me finish by sharing two very quick practical stories and examples to illustrate this in my own disciple-making. I could think of Ben, who I began mentoring probably now about 7 or 8 years ago. And I had told him, you know, it's great. We're going to meet up in a coffee shop and we'll chat and we'll spend time. Ben was an older teenager. And I'll try to help you with your problems. And we'll have a good time and we'll eat food. And I told him all of this. And the first three or four meetings was great. And we were sharing and chatting together and enjoying each other's company. And in the fourth meeting, he told me about something that he had been involved in that I didn't think was very Christ-like, let's just say. And I simply asked him, I just said, Ben, do you think that's something that's good for a follower of Jesus to be involved in? And he looked at me and he said, Rick, but I thought you loved me. And in that moment, he had experienced lots of the invitation, but he ran away from the challenge. And I hadn't done a good enough job at emphasizing that this discipleship would actually involve both of those things. But I can also think of Rachel, who came to me at the end of youth group one Sunday night in floods of tears because she was convicted of her sin. And she looked at me and she said to me, Rick, I'm just such a mess. I'm a mess and I'm failing at this Christianity thing. What should I have said to her in that moment? Yeah, you're right. You're such a mess. You know, clean yourself up. Actually, what did she need in that moment? Did she need some good advice or did she need good news? I needed to remind her, you're still a child of God. You're still loved by the King. There's grace and forgiveness available to you. In fact, if you feel ungodly, there's good news in Romans because it tells us that Christ died for someone exactly like you. She needed invitation. She needed encouragement. She needed the affirmation of grace and the love of Christ brought to her in that moment. So I'm trying to help you to see how these things are needed at different times and at different stages of people's journeys as well. Balancing invitation